Very good. All right. We're going to begin the afternoon sessions now. I'm trying to keep us on schedule as much as possible because I know a couple of you have to take off. Again, the afternoon schedule is we'll be running an hour and a half session now, which will run until about 3 o'clock. We'll take a break for about 15 minutes and then come back for about a half an hour or so of final follow-up questions so that we can more fully involve our colleagues at the other end of the table. If you would, let me encourage you to please do speak up as we continue. Again, we're trying to get this recorded, and occasionally we're having a little bit of difficulty with some of this, and it helps because the acoustics in here are a little bit different with the doors open. It'll make it easier for some of us to hear. So with that, Professor Neustadt, you'll be leading us off this afternoon.
Okay. I'm not supposed to leave for very long because I'm supposed to leave some time for Messrs. Moore and Bull to introduce this matter. Just let me remind you what this session is about. It says, working with and for the president's own style, political circumstances, and priorities. Now, one introductory matter before we get to that. We haven't put on the record something I believe is quite striking about the operation in which you were all involved. It's recognizably of about the same size and character it was in the middle 50s when it was started. And so far as I know, and you all will correct me if I'm wrong, I'm sure, if Bryce Harlow came back today, or Larry O'Brien, they wouldn't find it all that different. They might find Congress different, but they wouldn't find the White House operation all that different. So there's this striking uniformity, relative uniformity. If I have it right. About the same number of people divided between deputies in the House, deputies in the Senate, representing Congress to the president to Congress, got that duality, and trying to represent congressional relations in the mix of White House pressures on the president, all that, same kind of people. Mm-hmm. But just let me remind you think about the personalities, political situations, and motivations of the following named people. And if you want to go back to me, you start with Harry Truman, Dwight Eisenhower, Jack Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, the elder George Bush, Bill Clinton, and the younger George Bush. Now, that's about as diverse a set of people, of human beings, and about as diverse a set of political circumstances as we've ever had in this country. So you've got this relative uniformity serving this great diversity. And that's the subject for today. And I'm going to let Messrs. Moore and Bull in either order. Do you have an order? Do you care?
He's our senior.
Okay.
I got a discount.
I'm going to turn it over to them to get started.
Well, I'll kick it off. I agree with you, but there's one constant in all that, and it's the constant that Max mentioned the first day. What is your job past the president's program? Regardless of who the president is, what his style is, I would disagree with you in one regard. I think I had a lot less staff. I had two guys in the Senate, and three or four in the House. And I think in I know in the Clinton White House, you had four people working the Senate, not the House at one time. But I gradually increased it. I wish I started off with just one person in the Senate, three in the House.
That's tough.
But I think you're right. I think it is constant. The function is constant. The talking points that describe the situation or whatever. And let me just, I've talked about a lot. I came in with new leadership, new president, new speaker, new so-and-so. One thing I did not mention, and I knew we talked about it earlier, the transition, the Democrats had to learn not to get up every morning and fight the White House, you know, because it was now your own party. But transitioning from the election mode to the governing mode, and I'm going to name some names: Birch Bayh, Frank Church, Scoop Jackson, Lloyd Benson, all had run against Jimmy Carter in the primaries and all been defeated. Two people walked up to the wire and decided not to run: Hubert Humphrey and Ted Kennedy. Mo Udall in the House. Now, you say there are 535 that people look in the mirror every morning and think they ought to be president. Here was some that thought they should be president enough that they actually ran. You know?
Yeah. So,
and Scoop Jackson still thought he, you know. Benson was very good. I'll tell somebody the story the other night. He said, "I ran, I lost, he won, I'm the senator, he's the president, let's go to work. Tell me what you want to do." I didn't get that from the book. Mm-hmm. Other people. No. But that is and if you take a Senate, it has all those people in it, it's tough. Going right in, there was some resentment there. Mo Udall came very, very close to winning the nomination. People forget that. I mean, the Wisconsin primary, if he'd just, you know, a couple thousand more votes. But that's the situation we came in on. It talks about the personal style. I'll just tell you how we were organized. I had, it also covers the president's time. I had a block of time every morning. And I can't remember if Brzezinski followed me or I followed him. But oftentimes I would take time from him or he would take it from me. And if I didn't need that much time, and I think it was a 15 minute block, or I could go to 30 minutes or whatever. And on Wednesdays, the CIA guy came in, Stan Turner, brief the president. Oftentimes, he came right after me, so oftentimes I'd just sit in on that and listen, or sometimes the president would say, you know, Brzezinski, if he came before me, I'd say, "Who's in there?" And they'd say, "Brzezinski." He said, "But going in," said, "it's time he left, you know." So I'd open the door and say, "Come on in, sit down, you ought to hear this, you know." But I could use that time with my deputies or get a little committee together if we were working on something special, like Department of Education or Civil Service Reform, and you had a working group made up of OMB, and I'd use that time to sort of make a briefing for the president. But I was afforded great access. Anytime I wanted, I could walk into the Oval Office or the study, and anytime I wanted, I could go in the residence. And of course, you don't abuse that. Mm-hmm. You guard it. The president's own style, I think a lot of people have written that he was a terrible politician, he couldn't get along with members of Congress and so on. But I never saw that. I mean, he was absolutely wonderful. One-on-one or one-on-three or one-on-five or one-on-30, and persuading. And I've often seen votes change just by, you know, a presentation. You say, "Well, now I've changed my mind, I'm going to vote with you." Again, as Max said, you want to limit the president's time in making calls. President Carter was so efficient. When you give him 10 calls, you think he'd take him 2 days. He'd call you back in an hour and say, "Give me some more. I've done all these, you know, and I've got these two guys you said were on the side are not on the side anymore. They're for us." So he really wanted to do more than we wanted him to do. In that regard, because it's for this reason: if you do that too often, why in the hell are they going to talk to you? Mm-hmm. You and me, and say, I'm waiting on the president to call me. You know, he calls you every time. So you got to really limit that. At least I think that. Maybe you all disagree with me, but that's what I feel.
Oh, I agree with that.
Air Force One, I always had, I think, 5 seats on that. It was the old one. I think I had 5 seats. We could use any way we wanted. We had 10 seats at each state dinner, 5 for the House, and you know, and you usually, you know, foreign relations guy and the leaders, but so it really gave you about 2 or 3 that were discretionary and invite people on. It's not true that we invited Leon to the Japanese state dinner, thinking he was Japanese.
It's not true, right?
It invited Moneta to the Italian. It's not true. We didn't know the difference. But those are just examples. We had a lot of tools we could use. We did not have the Sequoia.
That's right.
We didn't have the Sequoia. We had the cheapest cufflinks ever made from the Democratic National Committee. They break the minute you tried to use them. But we did have other stuff. We had a lot of signing pins. And we had, but the most important thing we had was the president's time. And he never, ever in 4 years, I recall asking him or any of my staff asking through me for him to do something that he didn't do. Make a call, make a special effort. So with that, I'll turn it over to Will.
Well, that's a good, I think the use of the president's time we spoke about, Professor Neustadt, though the size, though the structure may not have changed since Bryce Harlow was in this position, clearly the demands on the president's time in the modern presidency have changed dramatically. And I think over time that has put more responsibility, dramatically more responsibility, on this operation we're talking about in terms of the legislative trains that run, whether the president is overseas or traveling in the country or preoccupied at a summit. And there seems to be a lot more engagement over time, even today, than there was in 1980 on those issues and those kinds of trips than there was in 86 and 88. So I think you look back at the day-to-day routine in the Oval Office with Lyndon Johnson, it's inconceivable to me that a modern president today could devote that kind of time to the discussions with leaders. That more and more is the job of the assistant of the president or the chief of staff to know what the leaders, the top leaders intend to do, want to do, feel like they need to do. President Reagan was one who set a tone of delegating responsibility. He told people what he wanted to accomplish, but certainly not how to accomplish it. And in some respects, representing his agenda before Congress was simplified by the fact that you knew what those principles were that he had stuck with over a long period of time. And so addressing legislative issues that would arise from time to time, it was not that complicated to ascertain which ones fit within his agenda, which ones did not. He had a disdain for bureaucratic processes. And when he left Washington, he spoke of the difficulty of any president moving the bureaucracy and addressing the alliance between the bureaucracy and the press and embedded interests before the Congress and changing the ways of government and how difficult that is today for any president. The force of his personality, the strength of his ability to deal individually in informal settings was a great asset in the way he dealt with Congress. He did not address, follow in the Lyndon Johnson way of speaking to leaders about detailed issues and schedules, but rather used his personal relationships in informal ways over informal suppers at the White House and in occasional meetings to which he much preferred to do as opposed to the formal settings of leadership meetings. And he felt like he got a lot more accomplished that way. And that was certainly an effective way for him to address the issues. I think looking back, we perhaps spent more time worrying about particular developments before Congress that perhaps were not central to his agenda, and that's one of the dangers of this kind of operation where you're addressing yourself every day, day in and day out, to activity in this dynamic process, and it becomes easy to be distracted from what is the objective. Now, Ronald Reagan was in office during the Cold War, and so there was no, it was understood that U.S.-Soviet relations were right at the top of his agenda, and the arms control talks and other other developments, and that was a, that, that gave a lot of clarity to what we did in that arena. But on the domestic agenda, it was then and is now a lot more complicated, as government is more complicated, I think, today. So while I think the structure, size, and the way the office is arranged is pretty much the same, the level of responsibility, I suspect, is much greater. The complexity of government is much greater. And presidents today of both parties, I think, depend a great deal more on the legislative operation because of the demands on their time and the fact that they are away from the Oval Office more and more as the years go by.
Mm-hmm. Who wants to pick up from there?
I just one comment about, you know, what changes and what stays the same, and I agree that it, you know, it's been so much fun to listen to you know, folks who have held the same position and realize a lot of the similarities, and we all had a tough job. But I think one thing that's changed quite a bit going back over the last 30 years is the integration of the communications and media aspect into sort of every aspect, and I really credit the Reagan administration with sort of raising the bar to a new level of, you know, when's the news cycle? When do we want to put something out? When do we want to do something? What are we doing? In our operation, our media outreach, communications, press operation was integrated into the policy discussions, the legislative discussions, in a way that I think a modern presidency just has to do that these days, because the news cycle and the shaping of events in that side is critical. So I think that our basic function hasn't changed, but I think there's an overlay of a media communications component that's changed over the last several decades that's integral to everything we do now as well.
It's 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
I mean, it's nonstop. I mean, you know, think back that it was during President Carter's time that we, you know, first saw Nightline, and now all of these things that have burgeoned from it, and everybody can find a talk show that they can get on to influence the, or try to influence the public discourse around the debate associated with the issues that, with which we've had to deal. And that's what's changed, I think, dramatically in terms of the environment from when you look back in the early days.
Mm-hmm. I told you I had a set time every day with the president. But oftentimes I didn't need it because of just what you're talking about. Legislative, the pace and the rhythm of the Congress at 6 or 7 o'clock at night, do a memo and walk it over to the residents, or put it on his desk in the Oval Office saying, this is what happened today, this is what's going to happen tomorrow. And by the next morning, things had changed. You really couldn't, I mean, it was a waste of his time and my time, most of the president's time, to sit and tell him what he'd already read. I mean, he could understand it real quickly. You didn't have to tell him twice. And you really couldn't predict you couldn't go into a 9 o'clock meeting and say, I think this is what's going to happen today. Because you really didn't know what was going to happen today. You better be up on the hill trying to find out what was going to happen rather than get your picture made.
Were the other presidents represented here, if I could put it that way?
Well,
okay, you go
if
ahead.
I might, I recall during the Clinton impeachment, following that with great interest because I found my mind dwelling on what was going on in the Congressional Relations Office, and I knew what hell they must be going through. And it occurred to me at that time, and it's been reinforced this week, that each administration probably thinks what they're going through has been the worst thing that's ever happened in the history of the United States. When we went into the White House with Nixon, if you will recall, the Vietnam War was going on. There were, I can recall, tanks being parked on East Executive Avenue. When I went in the West Gate in the morning, I remember having my car beat on by protesters. If you think you got trouble, was big time trouble. Then Watergate happened, and before long, we were counting impeachment votes. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the president resigned, and going through that,
I just you win, Max. You win, Max. We're gonna give you the mouth.
You win. Then let me continue. Then Ford steps in, and it's like going from "Hello, Sunshine, America." Things are shining out. The sun's shining again.
For a month.
And within 1 month, he pardons Nixon, and again the clouds roll in, and we have. The campaign's already underway. A certain governor in California decides to try and knock us off, which he came within a few votes in the state of Louisiana of doing. And then you get defeated. And there's nothing worse, maybe death is, but defeat is pretty close to, as I'm sure you recall, Frank. Mm. Then I think about the Reagan administration. We hadn't been in office January 1st. 2 months until the president was shot in the chest by an assassin. And I'd like to tell you just a quick story about that. The president was shot that day, and I was told to come down to the Situation Room, and there was chaos there, to say the least. Cap Weinberger and General Haig were trying to decide who was in charge. While the president, we didn't know whether he was dead or alive, and of course, Jim Brady. But the second day, I got a call from Jim Baker over at the hospital. And he said, come over here right away to George Washington Hospital. And I got in the car and went over there and went up to the Secret Service was standing outside President Reagan's room. And I said, what's the matter? And Jim said, listen, Mrs. Reagan is very upset. Strom Thurmond came over here and flashed his credentials and talked his way into the president's room. And Harry was laying there with all these tubes running in and out of his nose and throat and his arms. And Mrs. Reagan is very upset that here he is sitting in critical condition, shot, and a member of the Congress is in here, you know, standing by his bed. And so Jim said, I want you to stay over here and make sure that the Secret Service said, I don't care if they got credentials from the Pope, don't let them in here. So for about 3 days, I stayed over there and kept congressmen and senators from coming up there. They wanted to get their picture taken with him by the deathbed, you know. So that happened, and then after that, you think about the Cold War. In retrospect, the Cold War is all over, and we won and everything, but at that time, we were trying to get cruise missiles into Europe. Thank God for Mrs. Thatcher. She went along with it. You know, if we hadn't outspent the Russians, we might still be in the Cold War. And all through that, the Berlin Wall fell. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that when we're going through these things, and I think every president probably has moments. I read the other day where one of Bush's, I think it was a military person, said that the United States has not had as bad a times since the Civil War. Well, you know, where was he during World War I and World War II? And Korea and Vietnam. Every generation, we're all living on the same planet in the same era, but we're talking almost 30 years difference here in the 60s to what John and Chuck and Larry have been through in the 90s. So it's a lot of change and a lot of trauma, but each president has to confront it. Yeah. So I don't think we ought to, you know, say that this was the worst of all times or this is the best of all times. Each generation has got its own problems.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. It reminds me, that this will astonish some of you, that through the Truman and early Eisenhower period, the custom prevailed that any congressman or senator or person in the executive branch with a commission from the president, which meant assistant secretary or up, was entitled to a 15-minute interview with the president within 24 hours of asking.
I'm astonished.
There's nothing going on then.
When Jack Kennedy had first elected, thinking about his, his incumbency, Clark Clifford told him this, and he was appalled. It was the boredom more than anything else that I think he was appalled by. But it turned out not to be true, because after Eisenhower's heart attack and then the ileitis operation, that custom had departed from the White House and never was resumed. So I think it's fair to say that over time, presidents have shucked a lot of crappy responsibilities. That if you carry this thing back a little farther, that presidents used to have to take as a matter of course. I remember going through old Budget Bureau files and discovering that every letter from a budget director to an agency head, which had declared a program in accord with the president's program or not, was reviewed by Herbert Hoover. So these guys have always had too much to do. But it does change from time to time. I think it's very important to get on the record any, such changes as the 24-hour news cycle that not only alter processes and calculations, but actually change the workload that the president has to be involved in. I think this business of going abroad is more frequent than it used to be. There may be some others that have been happening, we haven't really noticed, that substitute for old-style busy work. But there's always been plenty of busy work. So,
well, presidents certainly have their own style in terms of use of the Oval Office.
Yeah.
Talk about
that a little bit.
Well, I mean, the press reports of the current president showing up at the Oval Office 7 o'clock. At 8 o'clock, chief of staff comes in. Things are running like clockwork, through the day. President Clinton seldom showed up. I mean, in fact, as you were talking about events and saying, we don't want to do anything with them before 10. And he would stroll over at some point later in the morning. You really used, and maybe increasingly, I'm not sure, his office over in the residence. Mm-hmm. Down towards the Lincoln bedroom, used that, and that would be his office, and where he would get reading and things done. And you can always tell, as here, when the president's in the Oval Office, the door shut back. So as you're walking through and really wouldn't be till noontime or the afternoon. But then you'd hear stories from members of Congress that he was in fact calling them at 1:30 in the morning to talk about this or
must
that.
Must have been popular.
Well, I've had more than one one wife, congressional wife, tell me or hear a story of the phone rings and yes, it's him again.
It's him again.
Yeah.
Well, one aspect of this also is personality, and I have a question about anger management.
Ooh.
Tell us about how you deal with presidential anger, especially as it relates to issues directed towards members of Congress. Will, you sort of flinched when I said that. I don't know whether you have anything in particular in mind.
No, I just, presidents are human, and so you see the, you know, when you see the full range of emotions in official and unofficial duties, and I don't think, you know, there are times, I remember after one meeting, President Reagan and, as Max mentioned, and Tip O'Neill had for many years, close, while they had ideological differences that were obvious, they had a close, fairly close personal relationship. But that's not to say there weren't some very tense meetings. And there were some, and I think the president felt like, owing to their personal rapport, that Tip should have understood certain things where they disagreed, and I remember one meeting where he clenched his jaw, and you know he wanted. I ended up receiving the brunt of a lecture after the meeting, sort of a "doesn't he understand" type lecture, and I think the speaker understood it, but there was a pretty fundamental disagreement there. I never saw him allow in a meeting his anger to. He was. Measured in his tone, and as I say, didn't relish the formal leadership meeting so much as he did the private discussions afterward. But I never witnessed what I would call a temper tantrum, but rather impatience with the inability of a member or two to come around on an important issue, most of which were foreign policy.
Fred, President Bush have a temper?
He's pretty even-tempered kind of an individual. You know, when you first start talking about anger, it's like, you know, the biggest challenge in life is to make sure the anger is never directed at you for something that you should have done or did not do. I guess probably the times where I found him to be most stern. Which I guess is sort of a precursor maybe to being very upset, was when ad hominem type of approaches were used, and you kind of got beyond the policy stuff and you started getting down to the individuals and taking personal pot shots at folks. And that was something that he just didn't think was the right way to govern or for public servants to serve. And so he would get very, very frustrated with that. And I guess that's probably where I saw him come closest to being just, you know, getting really angry. The president also has this tendency to, or this president particularly had this tendency to sort of get something in the back of his mind that he wanted to get resolved, and he would be impatient until that matter was resolved. And you might get more phone calls from him than you desired because you hadn't gotten the answer back to him yet. So those kinds of things. So an impatience element there.
I've omitted something important. I did want to add to the record. I guess the most famous, I was involved in the 1980 campaign, but I guess the most famous evidence of Ronald Reagan's temper was in the New Hampshire primary when he seized the microphone and said, "I paid for this microphone," and that was a defining. And those who knew him from way back made the reference that was, you know, that was the old Dutch Reagan. He banged the table and you saw a flash of of anger in his impatience. I remember that scene. That may have manifested itself later in a policy decision with the air traffic controller strike. I wasn't there at the time, but he clearly lost patience and acted decisively in that.
Max, how about the presidents you worked with?
Well, going along with what Will said, a president Reagan, there was one time when he was calling during the AWACS vote, and we were up in the residence, and he got Senator from North Dakota on the phone, and Mark Andrews, remember him?
Yes.
And Mrs. Reagan was in there, is in the residence, and she still had her house coat on. She hadn't gotten dressed, and the president, he'd had that trouble with the colon, and he was still spending time in the, and why he was doing the phoning in the residence, because he'd been ill. And we were down to a couple, two or three votes. Packwood was working the other side against us, and Mark Andrews was on the fence, and he had Mark Andrews on the phone, and he was begging him for his vote, and so on and so forth, and I don't think he was making much progress, and Mrs. Reagan said, Ronnie, you remember when we went up there in that snowstorm and campaigned for him? And the president turned around, and he said, that's right. He said, Mark, you remember when we were up there? And we got his vote.
Got his
vote. He wasn't mad, but he was on the verge of it. And then one time, on the other time, I saw a burst of anger, not from him, but President Ford. President Ford had a pretty good temper. And I'd hate to play across the line from him in a football game. But one day, when he was minority leader, we were working, this was during the Vietnam War, and they had an troop cut amendment on the House floor. And a State Department lobbyist was Hal Eberle, remember him well. And Hal had given him some language that the State Department had worked up on what we would take. And he was out there trying to sell this language. And in the meantime, he got a call in the cloakroom from the White House going around, I don't know who it was back there, probably Kissinger, saying, no, we can't take that language. So he'd been out there arguing for it. And his fuse just went off. And he come charging, you know, the double doors out to the lobby. He come flying through there with his coattails flying. And Hal was standing there, and he said, he took Eberle by the lapels and just put him right up against that marble wall. And he said, what kind of language are you giving me? He said, the White House says this language they can't take. And he chewed Eberle out. There were about 50 people standing around there. You could have lit a match on forehead. On forehead. But I never saw Nixon lose his temper, because I think he was mad all the time.
Yep.
Bill Clinton have a temper?
He had a temper. I mean, it's been reported numerous times. I can't say that I've ever been the object of it. Have seen him go off numerous times, but it always seemed to me almost theatrical, in that no one really took it personally. I'm not sure it was ever intended that way. And there may have been a kind of therapeutic element to it, and they all get frustrated. But I do think that he was, I should put in the record right now, especially given Max's description. I mean, I started to work there the very weekend that the Monica Lewinsky story broke. And so my entire tenure there was essentially impeachment related, at least that's the way I think of it. And it certainly had, I think, profound effects on him. John and I have exchanged stories, but he, I believe, became, as has been reported, and the term is compartmentalized, but he became quite isolated in a lot of ways. And I'd be delighted to share stories with Max too and hear how how President Nixon dealt with this. But to a large degree, we had to be very, very careful about how we used him in legislative affairs because of this. He, I think, was acutely conscious of the debility that it created, and therefore, I think, disciplined himself remarkably in how he engaged Congress and how he engaged congressmen. He knew very, he was extremely sensitive to the pressure he was imposing on Democrats and extremely sensitive to what the Republicans were trying to do to him. So though I think he does have a temper, it's a very real one. Stephanopoulos has told me that it's a very real one. Again, never hit me, but I think judging from the degree of control and discipline I saw in him when he was under extreme duress, my sense is that the anger was probably mostly staged or close to that.
Well, I mean, I was there in the two really good years, and so I never saw an outburst of any kind toward anybody, you know, and he was just, you know, always, honestly, what's the right thing to do? How should we do this? And very, very much engaged. And, you know, I think it's a tenor of the times. I mean, it'd be interesting to get Howard and Pat in here because that was the period of health care reform, the loss of the House and the Senate, you know, his low poll numbers, et cetera, like that. And so that was sort of the pressure period on the front end where the stories sort of come from. But I agree, most of anything he'd do, like, you know, goddamn or whatever, it was sort of off into the sky about why are these guys doing this or whatever. It was just sort of, you know, a way of, you know, verbalizing, you know, trying to figure it out or some frustration about something in the process. One attribute of his, a side of his personality that I found remarkable is particularly, you know, this guy was subject to a lot of ad hominem attacks, you know, throughout his presidency. But his capacity to not let it get to him and to be unbelievably forgiving,
right,
and have somebody who had just said the vilest thing about him 2 weeks before down to the White House and try to deal with him on an issue as if, you know, nothing had been said, that would have been beyond me to be able to do, to be honest with you. And but that capacity to be forgiving about some very, you know, personal attacks, which are the ones that do sting deepest, of course, was just a remarkable attribute and, you know, potentially a weakness as well, because I think he did engage some of the currents that were afoot in that direction.
He was, I think it was his wife who said, every day's a new day for him. And meaning it much more, it sounds like a trite phrase, but it's, we think about it a little bit, it is absolutely true of him. He did not look back, you know, he moved forward. And I consider it incredible, actually, given what was thrown at him.
Is this the Clinton you knew?
Yeah, and I agree with John. I think the stories of the anger really come from the first couple of years, which we didn't see. And in fact, I mean, Larry and I both started at that same time. In fact, we spent the first couple of months looking at each other in his office, saying to each other, well, Gore will keep us, won't he? but I think, I was going to sort of lament, you know, my situation, nothing compared to yours, but having a good Democratic member of Congress, a friend of the president, a friend of yours, look at you and say, there may come a time when we have to have the conversation. That really gets, you know, at just a personal level, your attention. And relating it back to the president, I mean, coming as close as he did to losing the office, I think almost put him emotionally, intellectually, in a different level, a different place, where he knew what he had, if anything, was more precious than he knew. So don't get angry. You know, let's just see what we can get done in the time we've got left.
Max, you had to deliver the news to President Nixon, right, about your vote counts in the House?
Oh, well, yes, we did, and we started counting votes in the House and Senate, and we would give them to him, and I think they, of course, they weren't good, but he had a defense mechanism that seemed to dispel anything that we would try to say. I don't think he really, I know he really did not realize that he was done until Hugh Scott and John Rhodes and there was a third, Rhodes, Scott, Senator Goldwater came down and told him that they couldn't sustain a support and that they couldn't stop impeachment, and if there was a trial in the Senate, it would lose. But that was very late in the game, and we knew from our vote counts on that that was true. But I don't think he would believe it until he heard it from the the leadership and his old friends up there. I want to mention one thing about additionals about President Reagan that I think is illustrative of his personality. As Will mentioned, we had really cultivated a close relationship with Tip O'Neill, and even though they both came from similar backgrounds, both second generation Irish immigrant, both Reagan came from a broken home, and Tip grew up in poor circumstances in Boston. One turned extreme right conservative, one left liberal, but they still seemed to have a great deal of magnet. There was a magnetism when they were together. But Tip, if you remember, in his public statements would be quite critical of President Reagan, and some of them were really nasty. Like, I don't think he's right bright, and he doesn't know the issues, and on. And President Reagan, somebody invariably would mention those stories in the senior staff, in our meeting in the morning with five or six of us. Somebody would say, did you see that? And all President Reagan ever said, I would expect him to just be furious. He'd say, oh, that's Tip. Oh, that's Tip. Mm-hmm. Forget about that. That's all he ever said. And the rest of us would just be
You see, we reminds me of a very short story I can't resist telling you. I don't believe it's ever been put on anybody's record. In January, end of January, 82, the Reagans had an absolutely charming luncheon to celebrate Franklin Roosevelt's 100th birthday. And they invited the living secretaries who'd worked in the White House at the time, and the reporters who'd been there at the time were still alive, and the people who were still alive had been in the White House and the government, and the people who'd written about him, that's how I got to go there. And it was absolutely charming. And the president got up, and it was a lovely lunch. He went into the Red Room and spoke to the grandchildren, all of whom had been invited. And he said, people say I'm against the New Deal, but I revered your grandfather. I would never be against the New Deal. I'm just trying to cut back the Great Society. I love that. Anyway, he gave a totally nonpartisan speech after lunch, and there was a large congressional delegation there. And then when it was all over, he'd gone off, and Mrs. Reagan had to say goodbye to all the guests. Everyone lined up to say goodbye to her. And right behind me was Tip O'Neill, with a congressman whose name I have forgotten, I'm sorry to say. And I heard the following conversation. The congressman said to Tip, Tip, he stole Roosevelt right out from under us. And Tip said, well, I guess he had a right. He voted for him four times. I shouldn't be throwing myself into this. I was supposed to be the impartial moderator. So I will.
Frank Moore, I didn't ask you about Jimmy Carter in anger. Did Jimmy Carter have a temper?
Or the hostage crisis and bad times.
I guess he did. I never saw it. His temper, I guess, took the form of more, you could see some of you campaigning or something, impatience with staying on schedule, behind schedule, a little impatience with people, particularly people he didn't mind offending. I never saw his temper. Never used with me or in my presence. Now, I've seen it written in some sarcastic marginal notes on memos. and they'll all be opened up someday about a member. And he'd make, you know, comment, and I'd get it back and say, "Ooh, don't let this thing shred this one," you know. But I think it took the form of maybe just cold anger more than a hot temper.
What about the hard times, the hostage crisis? There were bad times.
Well, he was just always just resigned, you know, we've got to work harder, we've got to do this, we'll be tried this, tried that. Just spurred him to work.
Did he become totally immersed?
He did. He told me, and I'm sure he's told other people, that the only time during the crisis that the hostages were not on his mind was when he was fly fishing. And he said, the reason is this. He said, when you've got the wind blowing this way and the water going that way, you've got a little, you know, teeny fly, and you're trying, you cannot concentrate on anything else except putting that fly in front of the fish. He said, your mind has to be totally on that. He said, the only time that they were off my mind was when I was fly fishing. Which is usually up at, in Pennsylvania, up north of Camp David. But I never saw, and of course I knew him before he was president. I was his number two, and then I was chief of staff when he was governor. And of course I'd worked for him for 13 or 14 years, you know, including the White House. But I never saw it.
Those of you who've worked for Reagan and Clinton, are you aware of any differences which might be generic between the first term and the second term?
Generic?
Well, I mean, which might apply to more than the individual president.
Well, I think, as I mentioned before, there was, Fred would have more knowledge of the second term, although I was there at the start of the second term. I think the key thing was the change in the chief of staff.
Yeah.
Whereas Jim Baker ran such an open shop, and you had Meese and Deaver and Baker all pulling in the same harness, and there was no rivalry, no animosity, no jealousy, no envy. They all were doing what they wanted to do and doing it well. The thing worked like a charm. But when that troika split up, and which it was bound to, it couldn't keep that up forever. In the second term, you got a more dictatorial chief of staff, and you it somewhat destroyed the morale on the staff. On the second term. I know it destroyed my morale, and I know it destroyed Buchanan's morale and Ed Rollins, and I can name him. Bud McFarland was pretty well denigrated, and and I think what happened in the second term, the negative things that happened in the second term can be traced back to that change of chief of staff.
But you wouldn't describe that as a change in the president's interest, temperament, concern, manner, or the fact that he couldn't run for office again, or anything like that.
No, I didn't see anything change there. He was still had the same drive, the same interest, the same goals. I know he was, like any president, I think he was thinking a little bit about going back to California. I remember one day before a leadership meeting, we always briefed him in the Oval Office, and then he would walk through this secretary's office to the cabinet room, and the leaders were all waiting in there for him, and we briefed him, and I could tell he's a little dragging his feet going in there. He really didn't want to, and we walked through the secretary's office where Helene sat, you know, and you could look out to the rose garden, and it was like in April or May, and the flowers and the tulips were up and the birds were singing, and there were two or three gardeners out there clipping the trees and trimming the bushes and mowing the grass, and he stopped and looked out there and he said, "I'd give anything if I'd go out there and work with those guys this morning instead of going to this damn meeting." getting a little bit tired, maybe.
I think, you know, the to that point, I think, you know, Ronald Reagan's Hollywood history and The Show Must Go On drove him in a disciplined way that other presidents have not felt bound to do, you know, in the regular order. I always remember going in before a joint leadership meeting that I knew was going to be unpleasant over a contentious issue. And as I recall, Senator Byrd had insisted on participation of some other senators who were certain to make the meeting unpleasant. And I had relented in a weak moment. So here we come with this cast. And I have to go in not only explain that the leadership's coming, but there are going to be some others present. And I could tell just he had just slightly this little look on his face of discomfort. And I as I stepped back, Kathy Osborne, who was then the secretary, walked up and said, "Well, you know, he just finished a root canal." And I thought, "Oh, the stars, getting him out of there, if I had I ever known." But anyway, the show went on. The meeting took place. And it was unpleasant, you know, I remember that at a tense moment, I think in that same meeting, he found it necessary to put that puzzled look on his face, and in the midst of a dissertation by a senator who's still serving, so I won't mention who it was, he found it necessary to pull out that hearing aid and dial, dial the numbers
which
a little
way?
Bit.
We'll never know. So,
but anyway, what the point I wanted to make was, I think while students of the presidency may assume that the second term is a time when the energy level begins to decline and the turnover picks up, I think the Cold War made it different in Reagan's second term. I mean, he was focused on the negotiations with the Soviet, his meetings with Gorbachev, and which became you know, very much personal diplomacy. And with those two, and the visit of Gorbachev to Washington and their meeting in Geneva. And that was really the, there was a lot of other things going on, but that really drove him right on through the end of his term. Mm-hmm.
See,
and he was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Maybe in contrast, but Bill Clinton, I believe, enjoyed being president up until the very last, you know, until they were walking out and playing Hail to the Chief.
Yeah,
and
looked like he enjoyed.
Oh, yeah. And I mentioned earlier session late in December with the congressional leadership doing the final appropriations package in early January. Again, you know, lame duck. New Congress comes in. You've got the lap of, you know, overlap of 2 weeks. New Congress, old president. We kicked around calling, you know, having the president call for an increase in the minimum wage. Just to really stick it to the next Congress. And but for the fact that we couldn't agree with Ted Kennedy of how much, which, you know, it also gives you a sense, I would say, of the, I mean, I think Kennedy, Bonnier, others wanted a buck and a half or something. And we, going out the door, knew that we didn't think it was responsible to call for more than a dollar. And we couldn't do it. And we didn't, you know, but that was the level of activism, and we haven't talked about it. But I mean, obviously, the very last day, he was down there doing pardons. Now, a few of them would rather have him not have done it. A couple you want to pull back, but still, he took that power of the presidency. I mean, Congress is not involved. It's a power that's inherent only to the president in our system. And he said, "Now I turn my attention to that." So up until the very last moment, and in part, he was much younger.
Mm-hmm. How old was he when he left office?
I'd say 57.
If that difference between 57 and 70.
Less than that.
I think right under 75 or 76.
Yeah. And he didn't have California to go home to. Yeah, I mean, he couldn't go back to the governor's mansion in Arkansas, yeah, which had been home, and was going up to Chappaqua, but that was no.
So
Chuck, let me pose one general question out of what you've just said, because one of the striking things that you pick up in looking at the last few years of the Clinton presidency is the extent to which there was government by executive order. There was a decision evidently taken at some point that there were some things that we could do without getting Congress involved. I wonder if you could address that for a few minutes. The politics of doing that, is that problematic for you when you decide to do certain things by executive order? Does it create a backlash on Capitol Hill, or as you're in the process of issuing these orders, are they taking your temperature so that you can take the temperature of Capitol Hill to give them feedback as to how much of a stir this is going to create?
Well, the ones I remember mostly are monuments, declaring national monuments. Again, the president has the authority to. And by and large, you're declaring monuments that our friends on the Hill were in favor of.
There were others too.
We did Roadless.
I wasn't trying to remember.
There were a number of environmental. There were workplace too. It was a conscious strategy.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was, and it came about because we couldn't get anything passed. Mm-hmm. I mean, we should be very candid about that. The record's clear on it. I don't think it was. I've got to say, I don't think it was our fault. I think there was a, subsequent to the impeachment proceedings. And even during them, I think it was very clear to us that the legislative routes were not open to us. So,
but were you actively out trying to determine what the how they were resonating on the Hill as these decisions were taken, or were you
no?
We didn't have to determine how those were going to resonate on the Hill. Those were done with the intention. Look, at the same
time, but you knew your friends would like it.
Okay. Yeah, of course, we knew who was going to be for him and who was going to be against him. But at the same, you got to keep in mind, while we were doing this, and especially on the environmental side, while we were doing environmentally conscious and sensitive ones, pardon me, we were also dealing with the writers on the coming from Congress that were the reverse. I think New Source Review was a regulatory an executive action, and. It was engaging what I think less so from our shop's function, engaging what was perceived to be an effort to hit the environment. This goes back to the Gore issues as well, and the fact that Gore was going to be attacked for environmental stands, and that there were efforts to roll back all the stuff that he cared about. So it was quite conscious. I think it was. It was governed by a lot of particular circumstances to that time, but we got no blowback that wasn't expected. The opposition to it was exactly the opposition anyone would have predicted beforehand. The support for it was exactly the support we knew we had going in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm trying. We engaged in. My memory is failing me on executive orders. We did some. Some of them were sort of reissues and continuations, if I remember correctly, of activities that had been expiring and that they'd been kept alive by executive order, as opposed to we did not, to my knowledge, except maybe a little bit on the civil rights front, get activists on the executive order. But I have to go back and refresh on that. I don't remember it.
Yeah, I'd like to follow up on this. On the Clinton administration, there's been some measures of the number of pages in the last 6 months of the Federal Register, the measure of all the regulations that went through. And truth in advertising, my wife was the lead attorney at OSHA for health standards, and they had a lot of work to do over the last 6 months. So what did you get together the legislative shop with the policy people and decide on the strategy of where you were going to push these new regulations and also executive orders, as well as a sole source contract to the University of California the last day of the administration for Sandia and Los Alamos to continue his contract for another 5 years, which I thought was amazing.
When I was in Japan.
Just to set the stage for that, and to answer the question about, what about that second term, you know, 97, his first year, was the balance of the budget. And in our policy shops, the policy committee, the economic council, and the various ones in the agencies, we were totally excited about, okay, we've got the budget balance. Now, you know, we were running plans for let's fix Social Security, let's solve that, let's fix Medicare. There was an ambitious race relations agenda being readied. So, you know, the mills at the policy level were hopping to set the stage for even more efforts. And then came the, you know, the Monica Lewinsky and the impeachment. And, you know, one of the great, you know, I think unfortunate things was that an ambitious agenda with the president with the energy and the momentum at that point to carry this forward was quickly taken away from us. And then, you know, and then it turned, I think, to sort of these second best alternatives on some of the regulatory front.
Yeah, and there was a lot of in-depth analysis of what we could and could not do.
Is that policy or politically?
Mainly policy.
Okay.
And in fact, this was not legislative, so that on a lot of occasions I wasn't even there.
Right.
But the, you know, I know that some of it was reaction. By the way, what John describes is entirely accurate. I mean, nothing could have. This was when I was going down. I thought we were going down to reform Social Security and everything else, and so the precipitous decline from high expectations to zilch was quite tangible. And I, you know, and I think over the next year and a half to 2 years, not only were we fighting off impeachment, but also fighting off all the kind of attacks that could be launched below the intensity of impeachment, which governed everything. It governed all the press, it governed all the talk shows, it governed all the discussions, governed everyone's thought processes. Well, below that, you could do any number of appropriations riders that did all kinds of stuff that no one was ever going to notice.
Mm-hmm.
And every year we would fight. I mean, the number of environmental riders on appropriations bills proliferated after you left. Partly because of Gore, partly because they thought they could get away with it, right? So the notion of passing things that were positive was beyond the pale. We were too busy fighting off the things that they were trying to jam down our throats. We tended to succeed in the last month of the year on the summits on the appropriations bills. But in the meantime, to get some of his environmental and workplace objectives accomplished, we did them by executive order. And then Bush rolled almost all of them back in the first 18 months of his, and well, a little longer than that, because they just rolled back New Source Review, for which they'll pay a huge price, but they did it. The ergonomic standards are right. And well, that was one that we had to fight every year. They continuously put in rollbacks on the ergonomic standards.
Let me ask a different question, which relates to differences. Party differences here. I've read in the last two or three months a number of times that Karl Rove has recommended so-and-so for the Republican nomination in such and such a district. Now, back in Truman's time, that would have been absolutely anathema because of what had happened to Roosevelt in 1938. One thing we couldn't do was go into primaries. Mm. And that logic lingered with the Democrats, although it's also true that, as Will Rogers said, the Democrats are not an organized party, and that may have something to do with it too. Now, I don't know whether Roe really did these things, really does these things or not. But I wonder from the representatives of Republican administrations present whether this was going on in, for example, in Reagan's time, Ford's time, or Reagan's time, or Nixon's.
What did Roe recommend, say that again?
Recommending candidates to run in congressional primaries.
Against incumbents?
To run for nominations. The kind of thing that It's commonplace in the UK, of course, but it's a different system. But here, once Roosevelt had tried a purge in the 38 election, and it had flopped, my guy would never touch.
If I might add, may I add three examples of this? One is Coleman in Minnesota, Thune, and this year Nethercutt in the state of Washington. They backed before the primary.
Right.
That's what you're talking about.
Yeah, the White House proposing people as their candidates,
right.
Proposing them to the local, state or district party people.
But that sounds a little bit, cheeky to me. I can imagine that the national chairman or the chairman of the Republican Congressional Committee or the party itself in the various states, but I wouldn't, I mean, that, maybe that's accepted now, but I find it a little bit hard of Jim Baker making a recommendation for a congressional district or John Sununu or even back further than that, Cheney and Rumsfeld. I mean, that's not their role to select political candidates. They're chief of staff of the White House. And I think it could cause some trouble out in the boondocks if there are other people getting ready to run. And the White House said, put the stamp of approval on somebody. I don't think that'd sit too well with other potential candidates.
Well, of course, I can't be sure that this current administration is actually doing it. I just read what I read in the newspapers.
Oh, no, well, you can't believe everything you read in the
no,
newspapers.
No, I know that.
They recruited Thune.
There's no question about that. And I'm sure they recruited Thune. There's no question about that.
I can't hear.
Excuse me. They recruited John Thune. Yes. There's no doubt about that. And they right, certainly talked to Coleman at great length. You know, I can't remember who the other example was.
Nethercutt this year. This year.
Well, he had certain circumstances, like when Senator Muskie resigned his Senate seat to be Secretary of State, then you had to have a candidate in Maine. And George Mitchell was a sitting federal judge, I believe, right?
Mm-hmm.
No?
Yes, he was.
And so he had to be persuaded to give up a lifetime seat. So there were no other, I mean, Muskie and, it was arranged and nobody else was going to have it, but that's a time when the White House, when you can meet with the president, you can urge them to run for this seat, but certainly it's not picking them. I mean, this party apparatus in the state, says this is the best person. And I can think of some other circumstances where the seat became vacant by death or a resignation or something, and the White House would be asked, or the president or the vice president, to urge somebody to run, but certainly not in a primary against an incumbent. But you just stay, you don't do that. You just stay out of that.
John Gilmore, did you have a question?
I've taught Dick Neustadt's book, Presidential Power, a number of times, and probably some of you have heard it as well. One of the intriguing theses in the book is that the professional reputation of the president has an important impact on the president's power in Congress. That is, if the president is able to, has a reputation for being able to deploy the resources of the office effectively, there is a law of anticipated reactions that people expect that the president's going to deploy resources effectively, and so they don't roll over, but they're more willing to cooperate. I'm wondering if you have experiences that are germane to this thesis, for instances of successful deployment of resources that led to greater cooperation, or the opposite, klutziness leading to more difficulties.
Stimulus. I think it's almost a law of physics that if you're successful once, you're better off the next time around. But I'm sure you're asking a much more subtle question than that. I do look, John just alluded to the classic one that I think was not thought of in our administration as much as healthcare. I mean, healthcare is thought to be the debacle. The truth is there was a preliminary debacle. And, you know, we passed Clinton's budget by the one vote, and I think we made it possible for him to govern, because I think if he did, that was a near-death experience.
Sure.
And it occurred in the first 9 months of his presidency. And I believe it. I'm not sure my recollection of this is right, but I think we were in Mitchell's office at about 3 a.m, and I think Clinton said that. I think he said, "I can govern now." Mm-hmm. But right after that, we had the stimulus, and the truth is, stimulus, at least politically, was as important. I mean, he won on the economy and the economy's weakness.
Well, the other side, you know, that you know, time is so short, but that I'd just like to emphasize is, you know, your ability to deploy resources in this job depends so fundamentally on the cooperation and the quality of the leadership you deal with up on the Hill. The amount of heavy lifting that the leaders have to do on behalf of the president is just absolutely beyond belief. And if you can't count on them to do your work for you, you're just not going to make it. I know that Clinton's first bill, you know, Larry and I were in the Senate and saw it firsthand. Without, you know, it was down to Bob Kerry's vote, you know, and he had a some Svengali out there with Texas boots on telling him how to vote.
Took him to a movie
to decide how to vote on the president's most important bill. But without the active intervention of Harry Reid and Tom Daschle to swing that vote and to get Clinton through, it, you know, and the time that Mitchell spent rounding up every single vote, you know, and I have to say, Tom Daschle has been, you know, was a marvelous help in my years there. But you just cannot overstate, you know, what it takes to get this stuff through, and so much of the resources comes from a good congressional leadership and committee structure, because there's no way you do it by yourself.
No, that's right.
And you.
I was going to say, I think the issue in this position, more frequently, focusing on the use of presidential resources is where not to apply presidential resources. And when you've got a broad-based agenda, you have a chorus of requests from the Congress and from the executive branch to elevate the importance of this issue and apply the president's time. And it is important that the legislative assistant, I think, focus that energy and time just on major priorities, and that entails being a naysayer to others in the administration, more frequently being an advocate of elevating the use of the president's time.
To add what John said there, for it's also a lot of fun coming into the job where the guy who is the majority leader, or the minority leader in this instance, was a guy that you ran against in the primary for president with Bob Dole. Fortunately, Bob Dole and George Bush developed a wonderful relationship with each other and worked very well together as a part of that process, thanks to Senator Mitchell jugging us on the other side. So it created an environment. They had to work together. Yeah. So thank you guys very much. I wanted to add another piece to what Will said. In terms of managing the president's resources, there's also the issue of using cabinet members instead of use our sub-cabinet members, but cabinet members to assist in the process, even though it might have been in a subject matter area that's not necessarily something that comes under their bailiwick. I mean, so that you can end up having the president and the vice president's time for usage when it really, really means something. Because not only will they stop talking to us, but there's the other sort of thing where the guys won't talk to anybody, and it's like, okay, I want my call from the president, and they want to actually talk to him every time, and they, yeah. So
my question really follows up on this. Ronald Reagan reputedly had operated out of Jim Baker's office, a legislative strategy group in the first term that did, I think, some of the things that Fred was just describing. What happened to that in the second term and then Bush and Clinton? Did you guys use any of that to orchestrate the day and the administration's day on the Hill?
Yeah, we continue in the second term, from 86 to 88, we had a legislative strategy group. It was, Ken Duberstein was the deputy chief of staff and Howard Baker was the chief of staff. It met regularly, not on a daily basis, but we'd have a senior staff meeting on a daily basis, a follow-up meeting with Senator Baker on the schedule of the day, and then we'd have a legislative strategy group on specific
issues. So it, yes, that was
and I think useful. The Clinton model tended to be more quote unquote war room kind of. I mean, a big effort, pull a lot of resources in together, set up some folks over in old DOB, and maybe even short of a war room, because that sort of developed a reputation or was looked upon sort of with disdain. Making sure that you had cabinet members working together, coordinating them. And as Fred said, if you've got the Secretary of Agriculture calling, ag members, even if it's on an energy matter, it gets their attention. So I think we tend to do it on bigger issues and the highest priorities, and probably less so on a regular basis.
On a daily basis, we did something. So, I mean, we'd have an early morning, like 7:30 or earlier, I think. I can't remember. But basically a message meeting with the press people and the chief of staff and ourselves sitting down there. Then you'd do this chief of staff's meeting, which was more general. And then we'd have what we called, for reasons I don't even remember, the budget meeting. But it was basically a legislative meeting where you sat there and decided sort of what you were going to do. And then, you would spread out into the larger group when you had the assignments. What was clear to me is something John referred to earlier, was the integration of the message stuff with the legislative stuff was fundamental to us. And I think really is something that deserves a lot more discussion in this context, because it's crucial. I mean, the whole press component as an intermediary between the White House and the Hill is another aspect of this that I don't think we've talked that much about. But anyway.
Well, gentlemen, ladies, it's now 3 o'clock, and it says in my schedule that there's another refreshment break. 3.
We're going to break for
15. Back at 3:15.
3:15, and we'll come back for a half session, full open round table, and tie up the loose ends.